Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Guest, I'm incredibly lucky because normally I would be interviewing those in the paranormal world and those individuals who may have experiences of spiritual activity or alien abduction, UFOs. And today I'm really, really fortunate because I've been allowed rein to interview Ron Chepstick, who is a very accomplished author, has his own publishing company, he's got his own radio show. And I'm fascinated by the type of interviews that he has undertaken in the past and the work he's done. And he's actually ended up in many ways kind of investigating the world of true crime and what that looks like practically on the ground floor. So welcome, Ron.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So I've got to explain to Ron that my interview technique is more of a conversation. So and a little bit about my background. And Ron, tell me about you growing up, your experiences growing up that have led you to be who you are and to inform what you do today.
Well, I grew up in the frozen tundra, more commonly known as Canada, in a city called Thunder Bay, Ontario, which is right on Lake Superior. It's a very kind of unique environment, very isolated. Although, we had access to the world through our port, it's a really a huge port. But I got to meet a lot of sailors on boats that came down the St. Lawrence Seaway when I was a kid. And they invited me on the boat. They'd tell me stories about, their travels and all that. And so I grew up with a real keen interest in the world beyond my city. I grew up relatively poor. If it wasn't for my mother, I probably wouldn't have gone to university, or might not even completed high school, but she pushed me, and so I went away to school the first chance I got. I was about 19 years old. I managed to make it into university. I was a real jock in high school, really good basketball player and a football player, and I focused more on that than on my studies. But I went away to the university, which is today known as University of Minnesota at Moorhead, and studied. And in my sophomore year, I met had a teacher that taught a course, broad course called Humanities, which everybody was required to take that was a sophomore in the university. And I really resented that. But I took the course, and it introduced me to the world of culture, art, architecture, and literature, everything of Western civilization, and it opened up a whole new world to me, and I became very interested in learning at that point. And so I ended up, and I did graduate with a bachelor's degree, but with no clue what I was going to do. And of course, this was during the late 1960s, and you know, I was caught up in the events of the time with the anti-war movement. The Vietnam War was raging, and it was very unpopular and all that. And like a lot of young kids at that period, I was really not you know, looking for direction at that point. But so I spent a couple of years just working, you know, menial jobs, which was good for me because it taught me that I didn't want to work menial jobs for the rest of my life. I wanted something bigger. And so I decided, being actually a practical person, what I would want to do. And I narrowed it down to journalism or librarianship. Journalism, because I thought I liked to write, even though I hadn't written anything, and librarianship because I wrote a lot, because I read a lot at that time. You know, I was very interested in reading after college, and I got interested in the world of culture, and so I decided, well, I'll go back to library school. So I went to library school and got a master's degree in librarianship, and there was a lot of jobs at that time. So I got a job as a instructor and librarian at a university called Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina, where I live now. I still live. And I became an archivist, learning how to curate important information from the past, which was actually good for me later because that's where my research skills came from. You know, I understood research, whereas unlike a lot of writers, when they start. And so I became an archivist, did a really, you know, a good job at it. I really liked it and all that. And I got a sabbatical to go to Ireland to study archival administration at the University College Dublin in Dublin, Ireland, around 1988. So I went there, and the Irish are very interesting people. You know, they're very good with gab, but they aren't too practical, you know, people themselves. But I got sort of caught up with with the spirit of writing. I met a lot of people that were writers and all that, and I said, geez, you know, one time I thought I would want to be a writer. Maybe I would want to be a writer. Maybe I can be a writer. So I started to craft articles and send them off, and getting all kinds of rejections. And but finally, before I left, I did send an article off to a British publication called Marathon Runner, London-based publication, and it covered the first Belfast Marathon in Belfast, which today may not seem like a big thing because it's been a peaceful period in Ireland, in Northern Ireland now, but it was very turbulent at that time. And I sold it, and I made the princely sum of, I think it was £50, which translated, I don't know, something like, at that time, maybe $100 or so. So I was really impressed. I went back home and started to write on the side as I did my job as a university archivist and professor. And slowly but surely, I started to build up credits and became quite successful at becoming a magazine writer. And today I have 4,000 articles, which I've sold since that time. And eventually I decided that I would leave my profession as an academic and become a full-time writer. And in 1988, I was on a press junket to Colombia, South America. And at that time, of course, Pablo Escobar, the famous drug trafficker, was running wild. And the Colombian government had an airline called Avianca, which they hoped they were inviting writers in, hoping to improve their image. You know, as a violent country and trying to attract tourism, which was kind of crazy at the time because it was a very dangerous place. And I missed my connection home and was lined up for a blind date, and I met the woman that became my wife, and we married and all that, which gave me an interest in Colombia. So I would go back to Colombia periodically and write about the drug traffic and the crime and all that sort of stuff So that's like an incident crime writing. And so I eventually took an early retirement from the university and became a full-time writer. And building on my crime background, I decided that I wanted to write more books. And so I wrote a book just before I left on the Colombian drug trade, which I sold and did okay. And I started to write about other books. And my first book I did on a subject called Gangsters of Harlem. And I had, in the 1970s, I had gone to actually a predominantly black school in Atlanta to get my master's degree. And I spent a lot of time going watching movies on black exploitation movies of the 1970s, like Shaft, Cotton Comes to Harlem, mm-hmm. Superfly, Black Caesar, and all that. And so I said, hey, there isn't a book on this subject. Let me write one. So that's how my Gangsters of Harlem book came in. And then that led me to a second book on black gangsters of Chicago. And I started to become inadvertently an expert on black organized crime. And so that's how I ended up writing a lot of books on black organized crime. And it just seemed to grow from there. And so that's how my career started, in book writing. And about 3 years ago, I made the shift from writing books to writing screenplays. And now I'm working on two option screenplays. They'll hopefully be made into movies. I have three other of my books options. So that essentially, in a nutshell, is how I got from birth to where I am today, here living in Rock Hill, South Carolina, as a screenwriter and author.
Oh, my word. I want you to backtrack a little bit, just a little bit.
Okay. Well, I covered the bait. There's a lot of things I left out.
Yeah, that's amazing, amazing history.
Yeah.
I guess for me, when you were talking, I was listening avidly to what you were saying and trying to think about where you might have been at each point in your life and each movement through to another part of this amazing journey. And, you know, from growing up and not having those resources around you but having a mother who was absolutely confident and empowering of you to achieve everything you could, to going to university, to obtaining your BA and then your master's, and then saying, do you know what, this is, I'm now settled, I'm happy, I'm married, and I'm now going to have this interest in Colombia. But not just Colombia, I'm now going to write about something quite specific. I'm interested in the drug trade. What was it? And I guess this is what I'm interested in, is what was it that made you interested in that particular aspect of Colombia? Because there could have been many things that kind of highlighted your...
It was a matter of opportunity, because there was so much interest in Colombia, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s when Escobar was running wild and embarked on his narco-terrorism campaign in South America. So it was essentially, you know, opportunity, because I had contacts in Colombia. If I wasn't married to a Colombian and had family there, it'd be very difficult for me to come there unless I was with an established newspaper. I couldn't do it as a freelancer without some regard for my safety and ability to find sources and all that. So I had the opportunity, and that's what I did. And of course, you know, I was getting paid well, you know, for my articles, because a lot of these it was supply and demand. You know, there was a demand for information and articles about what was happening in Colombia with the drug trade, and I was able to supply it because I went there and I was able to write articles. I had sources and all that, and that's how I, you know, started. And then, of course, it led to the book, the bigger book, because it wasn't a really good book on the aspect of the Colombian drug trade I chose, which was the Cali cartel, the main opponents of Pablo Escobar. And I was able to use my experience as a writer and my contacts and the opportunity of the moment to develop a career. I may add too, I've also reported in 35 countries, not just Colombia. I was in Northern Ireland when Bobby Sands, the famous IRA activist who was imprisoned and died of a hunger strike. I was in Nicaragua when the Contras and the Sandinistas were going at it in the late 1980s. I was in Cuba, and I got kicked out of Cuba because I entered illegally there. And I was in Bangladesh, in 2002, when the Iraq War broke out. So I saw the conflict from a different perspective than a lot of Americans and Canadians saw it.
I mean, clearly, for those people who don't know much about the cartels and don't know much about those kind of key and very significant points in history, they wouldn't, I suppose, understand the kind of potential danger that you were in at those times. So talk a little bit about the cartel and what that actually meant for you and what the risks were for you to collate your research.
Well, I'm aggressive as a journalist, but not crazy, right? I'm not going through a situation where the danger outrides the possibility of coming out of the situation. But I always tell people, I said, it always looks a lot more dangerous than it really is. Because people, even in war-torn areas, even if you look at a lot of places in the world today, look like really, really dangerous and look very difficult people live. They still have to survive. They still have to live. And they have to go on your daily things. And this was the case when I would go to Northern Ireland, too. It was a very tense situation. But people live very normal lives. And I'm always very careful. I won't take undue chances. I've had opportunities to do things, which I've turned down because I thought that the risk outweighed the rewards that I would get for doing the story. And for example, I've been offered different sources, and I didn't like the situation that I was in, so I never really followed up. So I think that I'm a cautious person. I also think that I'm probably a little bit lucky too. I've been in a situation like in Cuba, for example. I was there. I entered the country in 1988, before the Soviet Union broke down. So there was a big Russian contingent there, and I went in, went on a visa, and I put the that I was coming in as a librarian and on a tour, like an educational tour, which you were allowed to do. So I went to the country, and then I ended up meeting some dissidents, anti-Castro dissidents, and meeting with them, not knowing that I was being followed by the Castro secret police. And I was picked up and interrogated and told that I was in the country under false pretenses, that I had come in, and I was actually a journalist, and I put on a librarian on my card. And I was a librarian, but I was actually working, you're right, I was working as a journalist. I came in as a journalist.
Yeah.
But I had fortunately met an American that had lived there for like 22 years, and she was actually friends with Castro, and she actually put a good word in for me, because it could have been a very dangerous situation because there was no embassy, U.S. embassy, and there still isn't in Cuba, and the government would have told me, what are you doing in there anyway? You shouldn't be in there anyway, and they probably wouldn't have helped me. But she vouched for me, and so they gave me 48 hours to get out of the country. And I got out 24. I was on the plane the next day, and I left. And ironically, I came back 2 years later. And people say, "Are you crazy going back there?" But this was Cuba, one of the poorest countries in the world, and they didn't have any kind of system to keep track of people coming in and out. They didn't have computers at that time, really. At immigration and all that. And so, I said, "No," I said, "and they needed my dollars because they were desperate for dollars." And I went back on this time as a librarian for a conference of librarians in 92 that I did that and went back again one more time a couple years later.
So much about writing is about education, and we know that many things in history can be used to predict future, or at least the potential for future events. What would be the single most piece of learning that you've had personally when researching for your works?
In terms of my research?
Yeah, personal learning in terms of your research.
Well, I'll put it this way. Because I specialize in crime, I'll never be a criminal. I don't care how much money you might be able to get away with, because criminals never get away with anything. You know, that's one of the great lessons that's so obvious that I find it very hard to believe that so many people become criminals, is that I could count on a few fingers on one hand the number of people that that got away with crime. You know, everybody eventually pays for it in some way, either death or imprisonment or personal destruction. And so, you know, that's one of the, I think, fortunately, that's one of the good lessons I've learned. You know, I'll never be a criminal. You know, I'll always stay on the right side of the law. And I think that most people won't be that wise, and that's why I'm able to write about it and continue to write about it.
What's the most important piece of work that you've written about, do you think, in terms of putting a learning out there for the world?
Okay, welcome back.
I've done several books that I think are interesting. I think the book I did on the Cali Cartel, which was featured in Netflix, Narcos series, right? They were the third year of the series, Narcos, which was very popular on Netflix, and they were probably the most powerful criminal organization that ever existed, even more powerful than Pablo Escobar, but nothing was really written about them. And still, I've got really the only book that's covered their entire history of that organization. And I think that's probably one of my, I think it's one of my works that I'm really, really proud of. I think that's important. And also I did, Black Organized Crime's been underwritten. There hasn't been really a lot of serious stuff written about that. And I've done a couple of books on that subject, which I think is important. Black Gangsters of Chicago, which covers the history of organized crime in the black organized crime in that city. And I did a couple of major profiles, biographies of Frank Matthews, who's one of the most interesting characters. And Alan Warden and I discussed it on this show. And the other book is Sergeant Smack, which covers a really unusual angle on the whole history of the war on drugs. We have a black drug trafficker who was actually a master sergeant, not badly off, who didn't enter the drug trade until he was in his 40s, and conducted his enterprise during the height of the Vietnam War from Bangkok, became one of the biggest drug dealers, using the cover of the U.S. military to ship his drugs from Bangkok to the United States. And
How did you know about him, what he did?
Well, the reason I knew about him is that I did my book Gangsters of Harlem, and I profiled a gangster you may have heard of, is Frank Lucas, who is the black gangster profiled in the really popular, hugely popular movie American Gangster. And I profiled him, and he kept raising this name, Ike Atkinson. And I said, who's this Ike Atkinson? And I did some research, and I found out that this guy, in his own right, was a huge trafficker that sort of disappeared, largely because at that time he had spent 29 years in prison. He had been in prison for 29 years. And I said, well, where is he? I looked him up, and I found out that he was actually 3 hours from where I was living, in my home city of Rock Hill, in Butner, North Carolina, prison there, federal prison. And I said, God, this guy would be really incredible to write a biography about. Nobody knows about him. And I said, I wonder if he would be interested in my writing his biography. So I wrote him a letter, and I happened to mention Frank Lucas in there. And I found out later that he had turned down every interview during his 29 years, but he agreed to see me. So I went down there, and with the warden present, I interviewed, I talked to him, and to find a little bit more about him. We did strike up a rapport, and he told me that he decided to talk to me because he was really upset about Frank Lucas had lied about him, about his role in his relationship with Frank Lucas, and that you know he'd be interested in working with me on his biography. He's going to get out in about a year, and this was like 2007. I said, great. And what really was advantageous is that he would when he got out, he would go back to his hometown of Goldsboro, North Carolina, which was about 4 hours from where I live. So it was really convenient, to do the book. I got his cooperation, and he did get out of prison on time after 32 years of consecutive incarceration time, which is quite amazing. And I went to work and ended up with about 40 hours of interview. But during that process, I got to know the guy, and he was a really amazing individual. And he was about 81 years old when he got out, and just a really likable guy. Even the guys that put him in prison wanted to talk to him on the phone when they found out that I got out. And we all became really good friends, we published the book, and it's been optioned too. I've got somebody working hard trying to get into a movie, and unfortunately, Ike passed away at age 89 on November 11th, which is Veterans Day 2014. And so I think that book, because I had a chance to interview him, use a lot of records, talk to a lot of people that he knew that were up in age, that a lot of them had died after I interviewed him. So I got a lot of things on the record, and I think that, it was important from that perspective. So I think that's, also a very important project that I got involved with and I'm very proud of.
Very powerful piece of work. Why was he tempted to do that? What was it? What was the underlying? What's your theory? Because we can all say we do something because of ABC.
Well, this is interesting because, of course, I was going to spend, 5 or 6 years with him, getting to know him, and I would go see him, not even when I was doing, after the book came out, we became friends, so I would visit him and all that, and we went to New York on promotion and all that, and I asked him that question. I said, Ike, you had everything going for you. He was a master sergeant in the U.S. Army. He actually retired in 1962, and it was no mean feat to be a master sergeant, because he was black, and of course the Army, when he served in World War II, was segregated at that time. It wasn't desegregated until Harry Truman did that in the late 40s, 1940s. And so I said, you graduated. He was a professional gambler. He made his living at gambling. When he got out of the Army, Ike was able to buy a house for himself from the money with a swimming pool. The only swimming pool, house owned by an African-American in Goldsboro that had a swimming pool. And he was able to, he had money in the bank. He was gambling. He was going all over the world for big poker games and making a lot of money. And he sort of got into drug trade. And when he went to be with his friend, a guy named Herman Johnson, who was his partner in crime, who talked him into the drug trade. But when I asked him, I said, why did you do that? You had the money. You didn't need it. And he said, I really don't know. I think it was the adrenaline rush. And I would say, adrenaline rush? He goes, yeah. He goes, I looked at him. I said, yeah, I know. I said, you're a risk taker, and you just love the thrill of the chase, trying to outwit the law enforcement and, getting away with something that... that it would be difficult to do. And I think he had this character of a gambler, and he just applied it to a real criminal.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Right, it'll be like drug trafficking. So I think that was why
did he ever think he was...
Pardon?
Did he ever think he was going to get caught?
They never do. that's unfortunate. And I asked him that question. Maybe you should have interviewed him too, if he was alive, because that was another good question, which I asked him. And, you know, he said he never thought, you know, he would get caught. And he said, you know, you're caught up in the moment, right? You're caught up in the moment. And he had all kinds of money. Don Diva, which is a black magazine which appeals to young African-Americans, not only African-Americans, but white as well, but did a profile of him after the book came out. And estimated that the amount of drugs in today's money that Ike was able to transport to the U.S. was equivalent to about over $1 billion in today's money. And the DEA, he was one of the biggest drug traffickers on their radar during the 1970s. And his drug trial in North Carolina is still the biggest drug trial ever to be undertaken in North Carolina. And so he was just an incredibly adventurous person, and he never thought about the consequences. And I think that's what happens to a lot of criminals. You know, they get caught up in the moment. They're just caught up with the wealth, you know, the power that they've attained. And once you're in, it's very difficult to get out, especially if you're operating at that level, because a lot of people are after your position. You know, you get a position of power. And so Ike did get caught. You know, he got caught was sent to prison. You know, they had a lot of evidence on him, and he sent him to prison. But he never broke him. He never broke him.
Why does he think he got
caught? Well, you know, he I never really thought about it. The amazing thing about Ike Atkinson was his personality. One day we're going to, I stayed with him, and we were going to New York. We were going to do some promotion for the book, and I wake up in the morning, and I hear, you know, somebody singing. And I'm like, what's going on? So I go towards the bathroom. Here Ike's up taking a shower. You know, he spent 32 years in prison, right? And he's singing in the shower, like the happiest guy that ever lived. I'm looking at him and I say, God, oh my gosh, I can't believe this guy. I mean, his personality was just amazing. You know, everybody liked him. He never carried a gun. He never carried a gun, and he never killed anybody. You know, in order to, you know, that's the kind of personality he had. People were just automatically attracted to him because, he was essentially a good person, and unfortunately he did a very bad thing, you know, drug trafficking, and he paid the price for it.
I think we can all look back and we can say, well, this happened, and we look back and go, well, how did that happen? You know, what on earth was it that made me take my thought off of
you know it? We all get reflective. I think I probably thought about it a little, but that wasn't his personality. You know, he didn't really dwell on the past, you know, the mistakes and all that. He sort of accepted what happened, really, you know, without thinking too much about it, and he just moved on. And so he, I think he was able to survive in prison that long, 32 years. Can you imagine that? 32 years consecutive prison, living in a 6x9 cell, and coming out unchanged, because people said he was still the same person as that knew him before he went to prison, that worked with him in the drug trade, and like I said, even the prosecutors wanted to talk to him. Because they put him in jail, for a long stretch, but they still, in a way, grudgingly respected the man.
Yeah. And I think that, that says an awful lot about his personality and his inherent values and how people got to know him when he was in prison.
Yeah.
How did you find him? How did you find his adapting to, because you met him in prison. When he came out, how did he adapt?
Well, when he came out, he had a health problem. He had actually had bladder cancer, when he came out. But it was under control because he had a good prison hospital, and they actually took good care of him. But when he came out, he was lucky in a way because he was an Army veteran, and you can never take that away from him. And so he had Veterans Administration, health insurance and all that sort of stuff, which actually is really quite good. Compared to the general health insurance the Americans got. So he had that to take care of him. He also had an Army pension, which they could never take care of him. So he had money when he came out, and he also had Social Security from the government, because even though you're a criminal, they still pay it to you. So he had a pretty outstanding amount of money to live, but it was modest, but it was enough because by that time, living in prison for that long was a man of modest means and modest taste, and he lived that way. He was much more cautious when he came out than when he went in. The only problem The only problem was that when he got out, he started to show memory lapses, so he started to have beginning Alzheimer's. During the period that I knew him, got slowly worse. It never got to the point where, you'd have to be incarcerated and all that, but he started to forget things. I remember we'd go on trip, and he'd drive me nuts because he would put his glasses somewhere, and we'd go looking for him, and then we found out it was the most obvious place, his shirt pocket, sort of thing. And I said, people with people that have Alzheimer's probably identify with that. But so he was having serious problems. His family decided to take away his driver's license because they thought he was getting too dangerous for him to drive. So he was getting a little depressed near the end of his life because his mobility was being restricted, and he was a very, very smart man, and he was starting to have a hard time, living, in a normal environment. Although he could remember everything, from deep in the past, which, as I understand, is what a lot of Alzheimer's patients can do. They can remember the past, but have a hard time with the present.
Absolutely. What is the one thing that you learned about him that you wish you'd put in the book but didn't?
Well,
You may not put it in the book for many different reasons.
It's pretty comprehensive. I had access to a lot of information and all that, but I had to leave out certain things relating to his relationship with people and his family, which I thought would have made the story much more interesting and much more complete, but. I had to abide by his wishes, and that was part of our agreement when we came to an agreement about my working on his life story. So I left that information out, which I thought would have added to the bigger picture and probably answered some questions that arose in the book on that. So I really can't talk about what that information is, but that's what I probably wish that I would be able to do to make the story more complete. But it is, like I said, as complete as anybody will ever make it on his life.
I haven't had the fortune to read the book, but what would you say the book is warm to him as a personality? How did you strike the right balance between saying, actually, what this guy did wasn't okay, but who this guy did, what is, and his values?
Well, I told her like it is in there. You know, I put in information about, you know, the effect on people. I mean, it was when he was doing his drug dealing back in the late 60s and 70s, the U.S. was going through a heroin epidemic that was very similar to the opioid crisis we have today, right? That's infected the suburbs. It was ravaging black communities. So, you know, I put that in there. I said that, you know, that his actions had a dire consequence on events in the United States and was affecting a lot of people. And, you know, actually killing a lot of people with the drug. And, of course, you know, gangsters always say, well, it's up to the people to make their own choices, but that's not necessarily true, especially when it comes to drugs, because, you know, drugs like heroin are addicting. And people get into situations where they don't really have a choice because of the addiction. And so, you know, I put that stuff in there. I put some of his personal feelings with, you know, with his family, tried to be fair while respecting his wishes about what he didn't want in there because of, you know, privacy issues and all that. So I think I did about as good a job as I could do.
Is there a sentence or a paragraph in the book that you had to really query whether you put in, because it was quite damning of his values?
No, he gave me complete freedom, of the book, and he didn't really question. Everything was laid out at the beginning, and I abided by the agreement we had.
But I think what I'm getting to, Ron, is your relationship with him, because you can start to get to know somebody and understand them in terms of research for a book. But as you get to know somebody over many years, that relationship changes. So was there ever a time when you felt compromised in your relationship with him versus the information you wanted to put in the book and how that portrayed him?
Nothing like that. No, I had like I said, once the ground rules were established, I had complete freedom to do that, you know. And I put, you know, there's a lot of, he belonged to an organization, and of course, you're dealing with criminal activities, there's a lot of treachery and all that, you know, broken promises and all that, and relationships gone bad. And I put all that in the book. It reads, I've been told it reads, you know, like a novel, because I try to make it really readable. As well as accurate.
Was there guidance that he gave to you, for example, when you were having conversations and he was able to say, look, you know, this is how it was, but don't report on that, it's put you in a difficult position. Did he give you that guidance as well?
No, he trusted me, you know, as a writer to do my job, and I would go over things with him, when I went to a situation. Sometimes, like a lot of people doing biographies, I had to interview them more than a couple of times about certain aspects of the story, because I would have written documentation, and they may have differed a little from what he said, so I'd have to go over with what he recalled with the written record and try to get it straight, but no. He was very patient, and we never had any problems in terms of doing the working on the story together.
Because of those people he was associated with, because of his natural links, do you think he was able to protect you from some of that information?
Protect me in what
way? Do you think he held back from giving you information? Because
I know he did. I know he did. There were certain things that we talked off the record, which is, all journalists do. You know, you talk off the record subjects that can appear in the printed story, and and he would tell me things about certain characters that he didn't want in the book, which it didn't compromise the story, but I understood why he wanted to do it.
Yeah.
For example, I'll just use one example. He had a lot of money buried in and around Goldsboro, and he had one person that he helped him do that, and that person was still alive, and he didn't want me to mention that in the story, the name of the person or anything. I agreed with that, and I thought it was a good thing, and so I didn't mention that, for privacy issues, but it didn't affect the story. I mean, I still have that he buried stuff in there, but I just didn't mention the guy's name.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. I think that's because some people may have just kind of gone off and done their own thing. I think that mutual respect.
You hear that all the time, where source after the story's been printed in a newspaper, or whatever, claims that he never said that, or he was misquoted, or that he had assurances from the journalist or the author that wouldn't be printed and all that sort of stuff, but. I'm very cognizant of that, and as a professional journalist, I think it's important to respect, the wishes of the source that you're dealing with.
Absolutely.
Because trust is important. That's what builds your reputation as a journalist. And if the word gets out that you can't be trusted to do the things you say you're going to do, then you're really going to be in trouble as a professional journalist.
What do you think it was about you in particular that he put his trust in? Because as you said, he hadn't given these interviews before. He did kept quiet for 32 years, 29 years in prison. What was it about yourself?
Well, he trusted me because he knew I believed the story. Because for example, one of the claims in the movie, Frank Lucas' character was portrayed in. American Gangster was that there was a cadaver connection, heroin connection, where heroin was transported to the United States from Southeast Asia in the coffins and sometimes the bodies of American soldiers. And Ike's name was linked with that because of Lucas, and that's what made him really upset. And that's why he agreed to do the story to work with me on his biography, because I told him I would set the record straight. Because I believed them, because I did do the research, and I researched that conspiracy angle, and it was total crap. There was not a bit of truth to that, and that's in the book. So he was very, he was happy that I was able to research it, and write that part to protect his name, down the line, because everybody was writing that happened after the movie came out. Everybody was writing. And I came up with the first story that went against the 12,000 articles that appeared on the internet claiming that story to be true. And finally, people started to believe that it was true. And so now, it's been put in perspective. And I think that made Ike, very happy. And that's one of the reasons why he trusted me, was that I believed the story was true. And I went about... writing about it.
So who is the next subject of your books? Who would you really love to interview?
Well, I can't mention the name, but I'm working with a gentleman that's a drug dealer that's actually in your country who approached me because I had mentioned his name in one of my books. I have to be very vague about this because it's still not a completely done exercise. And so, but he's in prison now. He's supposed to be getting out by the end of the year. And he's one of the biggest dealers ever in Britain. And he wanted me to work on a story. So I'm waiting for him to be released. And we're going to discuss the details of his story and whether or not I'll collaborate with him on it, which means that I may end up going to England a couple of times to do the research on the story. But that's pretty exciting. But that's one project that may result, but But right now I'm focusing on screenwriting. I'm just starting my 10th screenplay right now. And so I'm marketing my screenplays. I'm writing new screenplays. I'm really excited about that part. And I think my life, when most people are playing golf on the, playing golf for a living, my life's turning in a whole new direction. So I feel, you know, very young and excited about the future. I just, you know, found screenwriting and I realized I can do it and could even be good at it if I keep at it. And,
how different is it, Ron? How different is it from writing your books?
Well, very different. You know, very different. It's in some ways, from writing a book, it's easier and actually tougher. It's easier to write a first draft of the screenplay. But it's so difficult to get it to the stage where you can, to the point where somebody will be interested in buying it and making it into a movie. Much more difficult and very frustrating to do it. But I'm working at the craft. I've taken a lot of courses and all that, and I've had success. Like I got one of my projects, a crime drama, is about ready to go into pre-production. I've got another one. I've just sent off a letter with the revised script to a producer that's looking at making a movie for 1919, a $15 million project. So, you know, I'm seeing success. And fortunately, at this stage in my life, you know, I'm not financially strapped. You know, I'm okay. You know, I'm living a middle-class existence. So money's not an object. I never thought money would be an object in my life. So I'm very happy. And I think that future looks pretty bright, and I'm excited about opportunities that are going to arise.
So just one last question from myself, really. When you're writing a screenplay, are you already thinking about those people that might be part of that production, or is that
sometimes they say, you know, a lot of screenwriters say they have an actor in mind when they're writing a role in their screenplays. I do that. I see people that could play the roles, but I don't think that's an important part of my job. That's going to be the producer's job. You know, they're going to get a list of actors, and you never know what's down the road because things can change so much, especially in the film industry. It's a completely maddening profession. You know, the major thing I learned is that you hurry up and wait. You know, just an inordinate amount of time go by before things happen. And for a guy that's used to making things, you know, happen very fast, you know, it can be frustrating. But I'm learning to be patient, and I think that, you know, if I do, success will come down the road.
Well, tell everybody, Ron, while you're online, where they can go to get your books, where they can go to get more information about yourself.
Okay, I have a personal website. It's www.ronchepsik.com. That's www.ronchepsik.com. And I have a publishing company that was mentioned earlier in the show, Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks, STREGIC books.com. And those are the two main websites. And if people want to connect me on Facebook, I'm always open to new friends. I don't Twitter that much. I'm just too busy on that. I'm trying to get interested in that, but probably in the new year, that'll be one of my projects to get more actively involved in Twitter. And I have my radio show at theartistfirst.com website.
You can it's indeed an honor to be with you this evening.
Theartistfirst is the network that I do my show through, and it's www.artistfirst.com. And you can look up Crime Beat. That's Crime Beat, the name of my show. And I've got all kinds of guests, including Alan Warren, who's going to be on again in the new year. And all our shows are archived for 24/7 listening. You can go there and download the MP3 of the show and listen to it at your convenience.
Fantastic. And I'm sure that my listeners will definitely go and have a look and listen to some of your shows. Maybe not Alan's, but we'll listen to others.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ron. It's been really enlightening and I found it a fascinating interview. And there are so many things we could have talked about and didn't even touch upon. But I've really enjoyed the interview, so thank you.
Yes, they're very good questions. And I wish you the best of luck with your new adventure on Alan's show. And hopefully we'll meet up again.
Absolutely. You take care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.